Hello and welcome to Before Our Friends Die. You're joined by me, Kavan, and this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. Today, you join me on a very special occasion because we've got a Jade conversation featuring Kat Joy White, author of This Thread of Gold. But there's way more to it than that. Marcella, if I may reach over to you, could you please let the audience know what Jade Conversations are?
Jade Conversations really stands for Justice, J, Anti-Discrimination, AD, and the fight for its elimination. In other words, in this conversation, we really reflect on ways in which we resist racism in society.
Thanks, Marcella. And let me tell you a bit about Kat. Kat is a gender advisor for the United Nations, writer, actor, and filmmaker. She grew up between Northampton, Yorkshire, and Wales before moving to Paris, Geneva, and back to Paris again. She holds degrees in English and French from the University of Warwick and Women's Studies from the University of Oxford. She was named in 2022 on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, and today we're talking to Kat about her book, released in June. This book is a celebration of Black womanhood and, of course, is completely in line with the theme for Black History Month this year, saluting our sisters. So, thanks for joining us, Kat. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
And welcome home, first of all.
Yes, it's so nice to be here, back in Northampton, back where it all began.
Wonderful. And I just wanted to give you a bit of insight into how I consumed the book over the last week or so. I listened to it as an audiobook, which was a really, really interesting experience, actually. I was incredibly moved and impressed by the emotion you portrayed in some of the ways that you depicted some of these stories you talk about, particularly in the letter to your daughter, which I thought was incredibly moving. And when you talk about past relationships as well, I found myself at times driving in my car or cleaning the house. I wanted to ask you if you're all right and if you wanted to continue. So can you talk us through that process of recording the audiobook? And I'll circle back around to the 2 points I mentioned of the book.
Yeah, definitely. So recording the audiobook, they asked me if I wanted to do it. And I thought, yeah, definitely. You know, I've written this book and it's in my... it's my story as well as all of these incredible women. So I definitely want that to come through my voice. But I didn't really think about what the process of that would be. And of course, writing the book was emotional at times, but it was also a lot more research based and long hours and late nights and early mornings. And so it wasn't always, but there were times when I would still find some of the things quite hard that when I was writing at the time. But yeah, getting into that recording studio for the audiobook, and it was like this tiny little dark, like kind of almost like a cupboard, hot. And I was in a show at the time, so I was commuting from Stratford-upon-Avon in time to get back for the show that night. So I kind of was doing reduced hours as well, which meant that I had to speak quite quickly, I think, and not make too many mistakes. So it was quite intense, I suppose. And yeah, I did find the process, well, actually, I think quite cathartic, because... yeah, getting to some of the points that you mentioned earlier, saying those words aloud, I kind of realised that I was reliving them. And I think especially by the time I got to that letter, the letter to my daughter, which perhaps we'll talk more about in a bit, I just realised that it felt like I was kind of releasing something, and it wasn't about me anymore. It was about who this book was hopefully going to go on and touch and change their life. So, yeah, I was sobbing at times.
Do you know what? I think that really adds to the authenticity of the book, though, because it comes through really, really strongly. And I mean, first of all, when you say, you know, you're on a condensed schedule, so you couldn't really make too many mistakes. I might show the outtakes at some point of this. I had to redo the intro once just because I slipped up there. So I don't know how you did it so smoothly. When it comes to the actual process, is it chapter by chapter? Is it go until you stop? You know, how are you looking after your voice at this point? I know you're an actress as well, so you've got to protect that tool of your voice. How does that come into play?
We just started at the beginning, went through it chronologically, and, you know, any time I would slip, we'd just kind of pause, go slightly back and go again. My voice was really tired at the end of it, and I was, because of crying and it being really hot as well, I was quite, yeah, headachy, I suppose, and emotionally drained at the end. But I did have this sense of like, oh, yeah, it was quite euphoric. And interestingly, no one's ever asked me about recording the audiobook. I've never really thought about it. So I'm actually really fascinated that you've touched on this. But yeah.
And then just a final point. When you write this book, what's the dream in the way in which people consume it? Because you know, like you said, you was asked to record the audiobook and that wasn't necessarily the first thing you wanted to do. So I can say from experience, it was a great experience, but what are your reflections on the way people consume this book? Is it via reading a summary? Is it via reading the whole book? Is it via a reading group? Is it via a audiobook? What's your ideal way people should consume this book?
Well, I think however they connect to reading, whether they want to hear something and kind of be moving around and experiencing it in that way, or whether they want to have a book that they can fold and write notes in. But what I would say is it is a book that is quite, it reaches out to the media as well. So it's, you know, it's got a playlist at the start of it. And, you know, I've given songs to each chapter, which I think is part of an auditory and also sensory experience. It looks at a lot of creative women. So I think finding ways to bring it to life, I suppose, and connect it to whatever is going on in the life of the reader at the time. That would be my dream for how they would read it, I think.
I did not know songs accompany the chapters.
Oh, did I not read the playlist in the audiobook?
I didn't hear it.
Oh my goodness.
I need to, all right, part two, stay tuned. I'll check out the audio.
I'll show you the songs. Yeah, I've got a whole playlist.
Appreciate it, I'll check that out. Marcella, over to you.
Well, Kat, I'm still trying to recover from reading this book. I found it inspirational and even perhaps a bit sermonic at some points, where I felt, in a sense, I was challenged to think about my own life, because somehow, based on your reflections on these women that you recalled in this book, you get the feeling that they weren't just living their lives for themselves, but they were living it for generations after. And that perhaps one of the messages that comes out from your book is the notion that I'm not just living for myself, that maybe somehow aspects of my life is sort of, in some ways, by the decisions I make and by going forward, this I'm being read. Did you get that feeling, perhaps that's what you wanted to do in terms of the narrative, was to say to women, yes, you're living your life, but you're also living for generations to come, and also for your own generation? Is it that we should see our lives with that sort of significance?
Yeah, definitely. I think that is such an important, like, that is the heart of the book for me. You've touched on what the book is. And I think there are all of these women, and I knew that I wanted to kind of have this place that was bringing these stories together. And I felt so clear that we could learn from, you know, Hattie McDaniel, for example. Her story speaks directly to Nina Simone, who speaks directly to Michaela Cole. And I could see these links. But what wasn't clear at first to me was, okay, why am I the person to be pulling these stories together? What is my place in this history? And I realized that it's that all of these things have passed through history to my grandmother, to my mother, to me. And one day, if, you know, I hope I have a daughter one day, and I want to pass those things on to her as well. And I think it was this sense of what connects us is our greatest strength. That's the most exciting an inspiring thing about us. And it means that when things get tough or when things are brilliant, we can also look back and see how our ancestors have also already walked that path. So yeah, I think it is. And then, you know, coming to that final chapter, the letter to my daughter, that was when I really thought, how can I look forwards and how can I pass it on now? And it is honestly like, it feels like you hand the book over to the next generation. It's yours now. What are you going to do with these stories? How are you going to keep this history alive?
So the tapestry will continue to go on, to be woven and interwoven through different generations. So it becomes intergenerational and transgenerational at the same time. I really must say, though, that I learned a lot. Not that I didn't expect to, but for instance, one character that I wasn't even aware of before, Mary Fields. Stagecoach Mary, really fascinated me. This woman dressed like a man, lived with nuns. Then at almost 60, she then got a job as an independent contractor to become a Star Route carrier in the Postal Service in the United States. What a character. And then you said that towards the end of her life, she was celebrated by her community.
Yep.
When her house burnt down, they all came together and they even did they also, like you said, shut the schools down to observe her, yeah. her birthday? Yeah. And I was saying, for a black woman at that time to have achieved such an honor really did speak to me. And I must thank you for introducing me to the indefatigable stagecoach Mary. That's really had a strong impression on my own life. And at this stage of my life, where I am now as a middle-aged black woman, wanting to know what's my next step. I think I was really inspired by stagecoach Mary to say, guess what, Marcella? Maybe it's only just begun.
Yes, yes, I love that, yes.
Yeah, so I really think that really worked for me, and I really appreciate this introduction. But also to say that, if you will allow me to just read one particular quote from your book, which really, again, resonated with me, when you mentioned Ketanji Jackson, who is the first black woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court in the United States. And you spoke about her moments when she was silent and the power of that silence and the sound, not just the sound, but the power of that silence and how she battled through the nomination process until she came through. But then you observed what her struggle meant for you and for other women, when you said in your book, speaking of that page 152, if anyone has a hardcover version, you said, just as with Ketanji Jackson, it seemed that the more that the traditional power structures found themselves faced with a black woman of unparalleled brilliance, the quicker they sought refuge in decisions that, whether they intended it or not, neutralized their efforts. And this, to me, is such a powerful observation of this process, because a black woman becoming herself and realizing her potential seems somehow to go against establishment and established norms of what a black woman should be and how we should present ourselves. And I really found this insight for me personally, and this sentence really is... it is so beautiful and such a testament of perhaps what you have achieved in this thread of gold. Now what I'm going to ask you now is to say, that was a statement, but the question here is, in response to that is, how do you think as women of color, should we think about ways in which we can ascend over the ultimate, what would I say, ceiling or barrier, which is contending with white power?
Well, I think Ketanji Jackson's a really good example there of that, because she stayed dignified. You know, the easy thing, or I think my instinct would be to say, to prove myself, to you know, try and look like I was dignified on top, and my duck feet would be paddling furiously and I'd be drowning. And I think that's how it feels like we need to prove that we belong in certain spaces. And I think that's the first thing that we need to say. We don't have to prove anything. We just keep going and keep doing the work and keep knowing that the fact that we're in these spaces in the first place, when you think about what it's taken for us to get here versus what it's taken for people who haven't had to overcome barriers of race and of gender and of class. And, you know, those already, if you look at that, you think, okay, I know I deserve to be here. It's not a question of whether I deserve it or not. It's just how I navigate these spaces. I think the second thing is about protecting ourselves as well in those spaces. You know, it can be, it is exhausting constantly having to navigate those structures and kind of battle, I suppose, to exist. So I think it's okay if there comes moments where taking a step back or having a pause feels necessary. And I think there's an instinct, I know, to always try and keep going, because we're not just doing it for ourselves, but I'm trying to also, yeah, think about what it looks like to rest and to take care and protect in certain spaces, because, well, we're no good to anyone if we can't do it anymore because we're, you know, burnt out or exhausted or depressed or anxious. So I think it's both of those things. Yeah, and then celebrating ourselves and celebrating each other, you know. Just been speaking with Patrice in the audience. He's about to do his second PhD Viva next week. And, you know, when you hear these stories, celebrate them, raise them up. And I think it's that as well. And the more people see us celebrating our own achievements and also bring each other's to the light, they're going to want to be part of that too. Because also, who celebrates better than Black people?
indeed. And that was one of the things that we were focusing on, even in terms of our activism here as the Race Equality Staff Network, GEM Network, here at the university, is that what we really wanted to say as well, yes, we'll call out racism, but we'll also have spaces and moments when we celebrate and when we applaud and when we bring to the fore the achievements of people of color. Because there is that part of the celebration, which in itself is resistance.
Yeah.
So whilst we're dancing, while we're singing, we're also resisting and we're also confronting. So I really do appreciate that the ending of the title here, which says, a celebration of Black womanhood. And what a celebration it has been, going through the pages of this book and just the gallery and the parade of women from strength to strength, the going in the past and in the present, and definitely knowing that it will impact the future.
Now, Kat and Marcella, actually, you both just mentioned two firsts in Mary and Ketanji. I'm interested because what you also spoke about in the book is the weight of being the first, the pressure that brings. And I suppose what you alluded to earlier is that pressure to prove yourself. As a Black woman generally, but particularly as a first. Can you speak more to that, about that pressure of being a first and why that is important and why that features in the book?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'm thinking, Marcella, you're probably going to have a lot more to say being, you know, as you say. Honestly, thinking about what you've achieved years before, now I feel like there is space being made in a way. But I do think it's an exciting, incredible thing to be able to go where no one has gone before, you know, and I think when I write about this, I'm speaking at one point about Alice Deering, who is the first Black woman who represented GB as a swimmer at Tokyo Olympics. And she's an amazing, amazing woman. But there's also this weight that you carry when you're someone that's being the first to do something, because you feel like if you mess it up, then that's going to reflect badly on everyone else who's coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to get that out of our heads. We have to just think we are not... We are carrying everyone with us, yes, but we are not responsible for how the world sees us and them. So as long as we know that we're doing things and we're trying to change things and we're trying to make things better, I think that's where we have to leave it. We're not responsible for what people think of us, and especially when we're talking about power structures and white supremacy. So I just want to encourage people to still keep on fighting the good fight and keep trying, because if a door hasn't been opened yet, someone has to unlock it. And why shouldn't it be you? You know,
I completely agree. And when you mentioned about, you know, the pressure of being the first, and that almost is indicative of how the trail will be blazed for others. It rings true to what you said earlier in the book when you talk about talent and Black people. And the notion that, well, of course you're a good singer, you're Black. Like, obviously you could dance, you know, those sorts of notions. You know, when we talk about our celebrations and our successes, they're never attributed to the individual and their hard work and sometimes the failures along the way to get them to that point. They're always almost exclusively attributed to their Blackness, their DNA. It was just meant to be. Flip reverse into other cultures now. It's hard work. It's dedication, it's sacrifice, it's all these journeys. And it's very interesting to see that dichotomy play out in real time. You know, one of our other shows on the network is around combat sports. And when you hear the way they describe, some commentators describe Black fighters, you know, they're talking about, you know, animals and that sort of descriptions of these fighters is rife in the field. It's very, very interesting to observe with that lens in mind. So, yeah, fascinating observation that you made there in terms of how Black success is attributed to the group and how Black failure is potentially limiting to the whole group too. So thanks for raising that. Kat, if I can delve a little bit into, because you mentioned about some of these stories, you know, from your grandmother to your mother to you. What was that process like? Was that something that you had to reflect on and realise, or was it something that you was conscious of from the get-go that, you know, I am part of the group. You may have heard of the phrase Ubuntu, I am because we are. Has that been a conscious feature of your whole life, or has it been a matter of reflection through the process of this book or just before the book?
Definitely writing the book has made me reflect on it. Excuse me one second, I'm sorry, I've got a call.
That's fine.
Got a sore throat, weirdly. But yeah, I'd say definitely the process of writing the book made me look at things that I've, you know, when you're growing up, you don't want to know what your parents have to say. And then I'd look back on some of them and, you know, I think, wow, my mum really has given me, she's given me everything. So much of what this is comes from my mum. It comes from my aunties and my grandmother. And even, you know, we'd like growing up, my mum, we would joke about her. She had these catchphrases. I remember going on my first holiday with my friends, like Magaluf or something, when I turned 18 and had got my A-level results, and my mum just like fixing her eyes on me saying, "Don't leave God at the airport." And all of my friends were just like, you know, she has these like strong lines that she just comes up with out of nowhere. But actually, they're so relevant. They have given me a sense of, they've given me my sense of justice, my moral compass. They've given me a fierce like desire to want to change the world and make lives better for other people. So I think it's not something you can take in at the time because you're living and, you know, you're in life. But it's when you start to get to a point of reflecting, which obviously I had to as I was writing, I suddenly realized that there was so much wisdom and compassion in what she has said and done, even though I couldn't see it. So I think now I actually do look a lot more closely and listen with more of an open heart, I suppose, to what I'm hearing from my mum. And then in terms of my grandmother, I mean, yeah, that's different because I guess you respect your elders in that different way. And, you know, stories of, you know, family are, whenever I'm with her, that's what we do. We talk, like she tells me everything. She's a big talker. She actually never, ever, 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 ever stops talking. So sometimes you're like, I want to watch TV, Nan. But also it's amazing. And I think she, the older she gets, the more she wants to relive some of those times and, you know, share more about them. That's in our culture, isn't it? As well.
For real. Mm. And there was a beautiful depiction in the book around you sitting by her feet when you were younger. And then now you're old, it's a slightly different dynamic because you're there to sort of listen and sort of see where you place in some of these stories. It's very, very fascinating to hear that, actually. Just secondly, if I can pick up on what made you pull that thread of curiosity to get to this book, what was it that made you say, all right, I've got these thoughts, here's some stories I know, I want to put them down on paper?
It actually started out life as my master's dissertation. So I was doing a master's in women's studies and I wrote my thesis on how Black women used food as a means of resistance. So I went from the Aunt Jemima figure at the end of slavery all the way to Beyoncé's Lemonade, which had just come out in 2016, the year that I was writing my thesis. And the process of like tracing this history and seeing how it was so relevant, like, you know, Beyoncé doesn't get much more culturally relevant and present than that, and, you know, having to persuade the academics that Beyoncé was like a worthy topic for a dissertation, but kind of seeing that and feeling that and just the process of writing that and doing that research, and I was alive when I was doing that. And, you know, ended up, everyone was saying, you know, this when you get your distinction, they talk about publishing it, but I kind of had the sense that it would be more so we held fire on just publishing it in academic journals at the time. And then, yeah, life happened. So a couple of years of living and having all these different experiences and starting to work for the first time and work for the UN and doing all these different acting jobs. And it was just building. I was becoming more and more aware that there was such a need for these stories, you know, especially as an actor. I think you become aware of the power of storytelling. And I realized that there are not enough stories of celebration and of empowerment for Black people in general. But for me, with particularly thinking about Black women, I didn't see those representations and I wanted them, I needed them. So then, yeah, I began to think about it as a wider book and had ideas. I sent it to a few agents, just like, oh, does anyone think this is any good? And then lots of agents were like, yes, 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 yes. And then I kind of was like, okay, it's got some legs. And then I really got to working on it and, you know, we built the proposal and eventually it became what it is.
Brilliant. And just to touch on something you mentioned right at the start there in terms of some of the potential challenges you had from academics and trying to convince them that, you know, Beyoncé was a legitimate thing to reference. Can you talk us through that? Like, was that a significant part of the journey, or was it, did it take not that much to convince them?
It would have been more significant if I'd stayed with the initial supervisor I was given. So I think initially I had a different idea. I was coming from more of a development background. I wanted to write about identity, and I wanted to go out to the Democratic Republic of the Congo and research. It was a totally different idea. And then I kind of, that wasn't, just wasn't sitting right, and changed it. But I had a supervisor who was still from that world, I suppose. And I've had this idea about Beyoncé, and I really wanted to, you know, show them that we could bring something that feels so present and so under-acknowledged in academic spaces, and look at the power of that and creativity. And yeah, it was just, people were sort of like, well, why and how, and how are you, what are you going to be referring to? Who are you going to be your sources? You know, like, bring me something more concrete. So I had to sort of go away and write more of a concrete proposal than I would have done if I was doing it on something else. Mm. But actually then got an amazing supervisor who was a Black woman, and she was just like, yeah, let's go, let's do this. And from there, I didn't have to do too much persuading anymore.
And that, I think, is a really important point to raise, because when we talk about knowledge and knowledge production in particular, there are gatekeepers to what is legitimate knowledge and what isn't legitimate knowledge. And if, you know, you'd have listened to that first person who said, no, look, I don't think that's, you know, reasonable, we wouldn't be where we are. So just keep knocking that door. Be the person to challenge those people who are gatekeepers and who are supposed authorities in the field, and produce knowledge that feels authentic to you, because you could soon be on the chair during a Jade conversation talking to Marcella and I. So what an amazing moment that would be. But no, seriously, it will be really important, I think, to just keep pushing that door and pushing that authentic knowledge, because that, you touch on decolonization later on in the book, and that is that. You know, new, authentic, different frames of references when it comes to knowledge. And I think that's really important to raise on a platform like this.
Absolutely. You are so right. I'm really glad you've said that. Yeah, that's a really important point.
Marcella, over to you.
Kat, can we talk about swimming? Yeah. And the sun cap? Because I think swimming is a powerful motif in the book and what it meant for you. So particularly as you quoted the statistics to show that the numbers of people of color who do swim is relatively low, and your own journey through going past the barriers. Share more about what swimming means.
Yeah, I mean, to start with though, yeah, relatively low. 90% of Black adults don't swim. 1 in 4 Black children in the UK leave school not knowing how to swim. And it's, you know, if we take it as base, it is literally like a life or death issue. It's a safety issue. Mm. Knowing how to swim is just, it's the equivalent of like knowing how to cross the road, or, you know, if you end up in water, you need to be able to know how to keep yourself afloat. But more than that, it's such a metaphor for so many things. And I loved swimming as a kid. I was, you know, I was privileged that I had swimming lessons and absolutely loved it and was quite good at it. And it was something that brought me joy. But, you know, get to that time, like age 13 or whatever, and puberty kicks in. So I think for many girls anyway, they're suddenly self-conscious of their bodies. And then you couple that with being Black and like your hair, and I used to like hide in the changing room so I wouldn't have to go in because I wasn't allowed to quit. And then sometimes when I've got found in the changing rooms, I'd sort of like make sure that I kept my head out of the water. And you know, eventually I stopped. I was just like, this is just not for me. But I rediscovered it in 2021 after a personal tragedy. And you know, it was during that time when we were in lockdown and we weren't allowed to do anything, and I just was living near this lake and I was like, I think I'm gonna get in. And I got in this lake one morning in like February. It was freezing cold, but started swimming every single day because it was something about, I was so numb with grief and not knowing where to put it, and it helped me start to feel things again. Ended up making a whole movie about that journey and that story that has gone on to, I'm going to Nigeria tomorrow to take it to the African Movie Academy Awards. It's sort of gone from like, it's an unbelievable journey, but yeah, realizing that it's about mental health, but there's also an aspect of wanting to change that narrative around Black people in the water. And we do swim and we are out there. And also we need to start encouraging people to try it. And yeah, getting to work with Soulcap, Inclusive Swimwear brand. And you know, there are organizations out there who are working to get you know, even if you're 60 years old and you've never set foot in the water, they do adult swimming lessons, and it not being a stigma, you know, it feels like if you don't learn as a child, you're never going to learn, but that's not true. So yeah, really, I'm a big advocate for the benefits of just getting in the water and shaking everything off and yeah, feeling free.
Can I just jump in on that one? So first of all, I'm learning to swim. So I do genuinely, when I look around the class, I see a lot of people that look like me. And it's there's almost safety in that, I feel, because we're all, all right, we're all in the same boat. Like, don't, if you splash around a little bit, don't worry about it. It's fine. I know where you are. You know where I am. It's all good. So it is a real life phenomenon, and it is incredibly important. And you write life and death. Kat, I want to pick up on something I noticed throughout the book. You got in water in February, you just said. That's not, that's, I don't want to overlook that. Yeah. Like, it's freezing. Yeah, me and my brothers, we do ice baths.
I said to myself, only cats would do that. You know what I'm saying?
But there's something in that, because you know, me and my brothers, we challenge each other on who can stay in an ice bath in when it's winter. Yeah. But that's a challenge. Like, I'm trying to win. That's why I'm in it. I'm not doing it because I like to swim. But no, there's no joy in that. It's just I want to win. Throughout the book, I've noticed you've been in certain situations where I thought, wow, but then you're describing them as fairly normal. You know, you've travelled through the Caribbean, ending up in Jamaica, but you was in a French-speaking, I can't remember what it was called. What was it? Yeah. So you've been in these places, and I'm thinking, this isn't just run-of-the-mill type stuff. Like, this is significant in life. Like, what is it about you that makes you take those steps and say, I'm going to do something that most people don't do? Like, even a placement, even a master's in Oxford. Those are significant points. What is it about you, do you think, that makes you go for those big things?
That is so interesting. I think you don't look at yourself and think you're doing things that other people aren't doing. But then if I think about it, yes, I guess I think I'm quite maybe restless isn't the right word, but I'm a curious soul. I don't think I could ever be in one place doing one thing. I think I want to see what the world has, and I want to explore it. I think, I don't know. I think maybe, I remember like my dad taking me like scuba diving with sharks when I was a kid. Like, I think I've had just like, you know, and like I ran my first, I think I ran a 10 mile run. I remember being like tiny and being outrunning my dad and people being like,
wow,
you're taking your little girl with you. So I think maybe it's this thing of, yeah, not growing up thinking, being scared. I don't think I'm afraid of that kind of thing.
That's really impressive, because you do marathons as well.
Yeah,
like,
I haven't done one for a while,
and
actually,
then you do a marathon and then you jump on the stage like
it's not sensible.
If I've got a marathon, I'm clearing the day. Sorry, I'm busy, I'm recovering, you know, like. But I'm just really interested in that piece of your character that says, I'm gonna keep going, and even if it's sort of untraversed land, I'm going to go there anyway and see what it has for me. And I think that's really impressive. And I think, you know, if people are watching this, that is something that you should take away and get in the water in February and see how you feel. Because first of all, there's health benefits. But second of all, once you've crossed that barrier in your mind, that threshold, you know you've got it in the tank. And that's really important for the many things that we encounter later on in life. And there's a recipe for resilience, which I'll reveal later on in the show. But again, I just wanted to highlight that and ask you what it was in your reflections that makes you to do the things that you do. I find that really impressive.
Yeah. Could it be that you're a high achiever, Kat?
I think I'm, yes, yeah. I think so.
It doesn't matter, but really, even with the swimming, I could relate to it, because for quite a while I had very long dreadlocks, and getting into the water and then getting it dried afterwards was always, no matter what, was always a challenge. And for me, that kind of sometimes was a kind of caution for doing regular swimming. But there was a point when I said, you know what, I don't care anymore. So if my dreadlocks was a problem, I then kind of got rid of them at the time, because I was determined to swim.
I don't want to take that for granted, Marcella.
Yeah.
I don't have dreadlocks. What does that mean? When you say it was a challenge, when you go swimming, what is the challenge?
Because my dreadlocks were so very long, and to kind of keep it away from getting wet. So after they got wet, the difficulty and the time it would take hours to dry. And if I didn't dry the dreadlocks properly, I could easily get a cold and get stuffy and so on.
How would you dry them?
just using a regular hand dryer.
Right.
But then that would still take time.
Wow.
You know, we take a lot of time. But then there was a point when I said to myself, yes, started looking for swimming caps.
Yeah.
And of course, thankfully, and I really could see where you outlined the story about how Fina then responded after representations were made to them to see if they could find a way to allow women, black women, to wear the soul cap, and what a struggle it was for that to be done. And of course, that represented a significant breakthrough, I think. And yes, I believe the whole act of swimming is also, I think, in this book, an act of not just defiance, but also, to use your word that you've used here, reclamation, reclaiming yourself and reclaiming. And I love it. Silence, defiance, reinvention, I think, is all sort of exhibited and demonstrated in the act of how you plunged into that lake and you swam and didn't worry about your hair, and how, in a sense, which was beautiful, how therapeutic that was. Yeah. And that you made that your journey towards healing. You found a pathway to healing that you needed to confront, which I think really resonates as well with me. And just to say to you that I do continue to do my little swimming. And after reading this, I said, you know what, Marcella, you've always kind of featured the breaststroke because I could keep my head out the water, not get my hair wet. Mm-hmm. But you say, you know what? What I first learned at high school was freestyle. And I didn't do freestyle because I said, I'm not getting my hair wet. But you know what? What the heck? Might as well get it wet. It can be dried.
I love that. So true. It's such a metaphor, isn't it? The water, yeah. Just like if we're brave enough to jump in, literally to jump in to the water, but also to whatever situation, who knows what we might find.
And I think it's wonderful that you're taking that film to, I don't know which country in Africa, is it Nigeria?
Yeah,
Nigeria. Because I remember when I went to Ghana, there was also much so caution about, you can't go to the sea, you can't swim. Because yes, there are some traditional myths and stories, but I think your film going there and kind of expressing that notion of the freedom and the kind of harmony we should have with the water is very important in terms of freeing minds and thoughts and traditional mindsets that sometimes impose our inner mental barriers to really experiencing the world as we could.
Kat, yeah. You're a writer, actor, and filmmaker. So for me, an obvious question is, why isn't this a movie?
It's a very good question. And actually, I had this conversation last night with someone as well. I think, I'm really interested in making it into a movie.
Exclusive!
Is the answer. Yeah, world exclusive. I think it, watch this space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And what's your production company? Shout out. Let
people... Cassini Productions, everybody.
There we go. Make sure you look out for this thread of gold production from them coming soon.
Somehow, Kavan, I just feel that we are lucky. We're very privileged. We managed to get hold of Kat before the work. Really, she burnt soul, because somehow I feel that we're just at the beginning stage, or not necessarily the beginning stage, but a stage before... We'll have to perhaps knock on many doors before we could get through to Kat.
You're always going to have my number.
I know. But I think it is timely. And I think where this is going is going to be big. Really big.
Well, Marcella, do you remember?
Yeah.
Our last guest on Jade Conversations, Professor Jason Arday.
Of course.
About a month after the episode was released, he was announced as the first black professor at Cambridge
University.
Or the youngest.
We are the youngest. Somehow we feel as though,
Springboard.
We have been kind of privileged here in our Jade Conversations in terms of our guests that we have had.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, we are going to definitely watch this space.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
This is called the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network, and this show in particular is Before Our Friends Die. Aki and Saltfish, a dish you and I, all of us actually, are incredibly familiar with. So familiar actually that I had to call my network. It was so close to my heart. Cooking is an act of resistance. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Well, when you think of cooking, you think of very gendered spaces and you think of women in particular being in the kitchen, perhaps not wanting to be there, but, you know, cooking, feeding families, domestic servitude, all those kind of words and connotations. But I think that the kitchen is a space of creativity. And I think it's a space where actually throughout history, it's one of the only spaces where, if you even go back as far as, you know, slavery, Black women were in control in the kitchen and it was their domain and they were able to create worlds and uplift themselves through food. But also I think, you know, there's so much around like communal eating and being together and what our food means to us and what we can do with ingredients and, you know, coming back to this reclaiming land and thinking about, yeah, where food comes from. And like, you are what you eat, quite literally, you know, if we put the right things in us, what does that mean for who we are? And I'm just fascinated by it. It's actually, yeah, I'm working on something around this very topic as we speak.
Exclusive again, come on.
Two exclusives in one show. Go oh my on. Goodness.
Wicked. Well, I look forward to that. And please do keep us in the loop because we'd love to share with the audience what we find. On that, actually, if I can talk to you a little bit about three questions you raise in the book that I found really, really interesting. And I'm going to ask you both, if you don't mind, to respond to this. So, Marcella, I'll start with you because, Kat, I feel like you're going to have a heads up anyway. What does beauty mean to you?
I think beauty means to me the act of being yourself, being original, and not trying to conform necessarily. Yes, there are certain parts of beauty where you look for peer affirmation, where you look to be part of the group. But I think real beauty is the power, the strength to be authentically who you are.
And what do you find beautiful about yourself, Marcella?
To be honest, I tend to spend most of my time, as you know of me, always affirming the beauty in others. And maybe, perhaps that's what I should celebrate about myself. But I do have the capacity to celebrate and to affirm the beauty of others. And I think, if I'm going to tell you something, what I think is beautiful about me, I would say is that I love to smile. And I think I have a lovely voice.
You do. I want to listen to you.
So I think... Yeah, I'm not going to be all, you know, wallflower and say there's nothing beautiful about me. Yes, there is. And I think I've shared that with you. Why do you always do that, Kavan?
Sorry.
You always go for the jugular with me.
there's actually another question. And you can blame Kat about these questions, by the way.
Oh, yes.
What do you do to embrace your beauty, Marcella?
What do I do to embrace my beauty?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps I haven't thought about that enough, and that has been... perhaps one of the challenges of Kat's book and why I think, as I said, I'm still trying to get over it. I haven't gotten over it yet. It has had such an impression on me. And I think that is an area I need to work on. I think, affirm more of that sense of, you know, you're beautiful.
Do you know what?
Well, inner dialogue from time to time, perhaps.
That inner voice is important.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? If you've watched this just now, mm-hmm. what a moment that just was, you know, for us all to connect. And mm-hmm. Kat, your book did that. Those questions mm-hmm. you raised, those 50 Black women you asked about those three questions. Yeah. It's a really, really important moment. And just to say, if you are a fan of Marcella's voice, make sure you go back in the archives and check out episodes 33 and 34, because those are episodes that focus on Marcella's work in travel and tourism in the UK. So you'd be interested in hearing more about that. But Kat, back to you. I want to read a quote. Just like the four women who came before, the 50 women that came after, and the next generation still to come, we have the power within us to invoke a revolution or to quietly, gradually heal. Change is whenever we need it to be. And most important of all, it is already within us. When did you realize change was within you?
I think when I started to feel as though I didn't have to be anything to anyone anymore, I could do what I felt like I was put on this earth for, which came, you know, relatively recently after some of the events that I write about, you know, this relationship and different things. It took some low points, I think, some hard times to be able to realize that I'm not waiting for anyone to make me better or to change my life. I can do that myself.
And this is an autobiographical book as much as it's a historical book as well. So I'm intrigued. What stories had to find you? And what stories found you? And which stories did you find? I.e., what was already familiar to you? And what was new knowledge?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, if you look at someone like Rosa Parks, we grew up, probably most people in the world have heard of Rosa Parks. Mm. And, you know, she's an amazing inspiration. But, you know, Claudette Colvin was someone who I got to know more about.
Yeah.
Who refused to give up her seat on the bus before Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And that taught me a lot because, you know, she was dark skinned and she was 15 and she was from the wrong side of town and she was pregnant outside of marriage and she wasn't the right fit to be the face of the movement. So she got put down and, you know, ignored, and history has kind of forgotten about her. You can find enough about her if you look hard enough, but stop anyone on the street and say, do you know who Claudette Colvin is? They're probably going to say no. So I think I knew lots of the stories of women like Rosa Parks. But when you look deeper, you can see that they lead you to so many other women who haven't been acknowledged. And I think that was one of the most like exciting and also to me felt like the most groundbreaking things in doing this research. Who, you know, did I already have in my heart? I mean, Michaela Cole, I write a lot about. She somehow I feel connected to her. I've never met her. But I don't know why, it's quite probably weird to say that. But like I somehow feel connected to her. And that thing of silence, like, you know, just not being afraid of silence, like sit with it. Don't worry, you know, like great things can come out of these dark and quiet moments. And that really resonated with me. And I think she would be one of the people I'd say that she found me, I think, rather than me finding her.
You mentioned just then about Rosa Parks being the right fit for that narrative. And you do allude throughout the book of some of the benefits that you get from being pretty, that privilege that comes with that. Do you feel like, in essence, you have a responsibility because of the spaces you can access to share these stories that were perhaps hidden previously?
Yeah, like 100%. I think that is so important. And it's, I think any privilege that we have is so important to call it out, because we're not all on a level playing field, you know, in the same way that we want now and expect now to hear white men, for example, say, this has been easier for me because of this. And I think even when you're still within a marginalized community or many different demographics of marginalized communities, it's still important to say, but actually people are like letting me sit down on a busy train because they think, oh, there's, you know, there's all sorts of different things that I have access to that other people don't. And even you can create those spaces for yourself in terms of like creating my education and being able to go to somewhere like Oxford, which unlocked so many doors for me that I would never have had access to otherwise from the world I was in before. And I think I believe that calling out that is helpful because it doesn't give a false impression to other people who might not have, they might have to work harder to get into those spaces. Mm. So I want to do that. I think that is an important part of also uplifting others and making space, knowing when it's not time for me to speak, it's time for me to be quiet, or knowing when it's time for me to call out certain things. So yeah, I want to always be, that's one of my biggest, you know, ambitions, I think, to make sure that I'm not taking spaces that I don't need to, and making sure that I acknowledge when I've benefited from something that someone else will never have the opportunity to benefit from.
Thank you for that answer.
Kat, increasingly we're hearing discourses about the whole notion of that we're in a post-racial society. Sometimes we even hear people content to say, this is the best time ever for people of color to be living. How do you see your work in terms of playing a role in ensuring that we keep this, or put it in this way, our foot on the anti-racism pedal going forward?
Well, my work is interesting because it exists in the space of celebration. So I try to avoid, I think the way we can see some of the oppressions that still exist is by looking at all that we have to celebrate. So I think for me, it's about keeping conversations alive, because how people can say that there's never been a better time to be a person of color is beyond me. But I think my coping mechanism, my way of dealing with it, my ambition and drive in how we can change it is to make sure that we are celebrating, we are uplifting, we are making space for as many of us as possible to come through. And even if it's a simple tiny thing, like, I don't know, going, meeting someone coming home from school and say, like, asking what they're learning today and saying, well done, that's brilliant, encouraging it. Or it might be something bigger, like making a whole movie. And, you know, it's, for me, it's about making sure that we keep those conversations going and we don't let things drop. And of course, when we need to call out oppression and things that we see, making sure that we are there and being a voice for that.
Kat, one of the final questions from me is, what, if anything, did this book force you to unlearn?
It's definitely about... I mean, you've spoken about it as a good thing, and it is a good thing. I do like that I do everything all the time. I am proud of that. But I also, it made me learn that I don't have to, you know, I don't have to be having 5 full-time jobs. It's great because I want to, but, you know, I'm not a machine. I'm a human. And I think getting to that point, I did get to that point this year where I was like, I just was so overwhelmed and, you know, got diagnosed with burnout. And just recognizing that and not being like, 1 year I would never admit that. I'd be like, I'm absolutely fine. Like, I'm this, I'm that. Whereas now I'm kind of like, okay, I can't do everything. And that's okay. That is actually okay.
Do you know what? Peeling the curtain back a little bit. Marcella and I have conversations quite often. You know, I'm tired, man. I'm just tired, man. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm just tired. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you do to sort of decompress, Kat, in terms of, you know, post burnout, what are you trying to do to replenish yourself? Mm-hmm. Just advice for Marcelo and I, literally, but also the audience, figuratively, you may be tuning into this.
Yeah. I mean, the first one is not the easiest. You have to take a long, hard look at what you have in your life, and you have to look at what you can strip away. And that isn't easy, because probably if you're diagnosed with burnout, you're the kind of person that doesn't want to strip anything away. But it's essential. You will not get out of it if you don't. So look at what, really think about what makes your heart sing. And if there's, you can spot something that clearly doesn't do that, that's probably where you're going to start. And I guess depending how severe it is, you might end up having to take a step back from some of the things that do make your heart sing as well. But knowing that that's not permanent. And then find the things that when you're in them, you don't feel like you're needing to be anything or do anything. Not the things that make your heart race with anxiety. Find the things that make you feel peaceful. So for me, like, running was always my greatest joy, and it was one of the first things that ended up going when I was, you know, traveling all the time and doing all these things, because it's like, I don't have time to go for a run. But actually, if I can get out, honestly, for 10 or 15 minutes, my whole day changes. So for me, it's like, if I can find the time to do a run in the day, that's my, like, my little thing. It's my little piece of time just for myself. And yeah, swimming became that as well. But it's obviously, you don't always have access to water, but that would be for me. But for some people, it would be, you know, like, I don't know, baking or a phone call with their mom, or, you know, finding that one thing that will always bring you peace, and just make time for it no matter what. It doesn't matter if you have to clear your calendar, like, you're unavailable. Put yourself as unavailable and don't tell them why, but that's what you're doing.
Agree. I mean, and I'm not asking for an answer here that makes sense, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. And Marcelo, I'd like your thoughts on this as well. Because earlier you spoke about, you almost feel like this book was a responsibility to share these stories and to pass it on to the next generation. And I think there's a worthy connection between Marcella, myself and yourself, in the sense that we're doing work that we feel we should do. We want to do it. It definitely makes our hearts sing. It's important to us, but we also feel a responsibility to do this work too. I suppose the question is, how do you reconcile the conflict between I want to do this work to advance myself and others, and this work is tiring, hard, challenging, uphill? Not always, you know, I must say it is often pleasant. Later on, I believe there's jerk chicken that's free and, you know, planting and all sorts. So stick around if you're around, you know what I mean? But my point is, there is sometimes a natural conflict happening between when you work in this space. So how do you reconcile that whilst meeting your responsibility? Or do we shake the fact that it's a responsibility and call it our purpose? Or what, you know, there's a real, it doesn't align all the time. So just reflections, I suppose, on that. Marcella, I'll start with you because
Yeah, I guess there are some days when you get up in the morning and you ask yourself the question, is it worth it to continue to be in this space? Because oftentimes there isn't much sort of celebratory moments. In fact, as Kat has told us, you have to create those celebratory moments.
Yeah, true.
And you have to ensure that you do take time out to preserve yourself, because it is sometimes an unrelenting battle. And in oftentimes you find yourself, even in establishment or with institutions, not being considered to be their Negro. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. I am not your Negro. And so it even becomes lonelier and even more isolating, because there are others who are accepted as the Negro, who is more comfortably placed within the institution and establishment. So it is really a sense of alienation, always feeling of being an outsider and not knowing how to then get your message across to be acceptable, because, you know, we're in a space where we're wanting to get the message across to say, hey, here we are struggling against this really intransient problem of racism, and we can together defeat it. But oftentimes we're not listened to. So yes, it is exhausting. But thankfully, as Kat has, and I want to say thanks to Kat as well for inviting us into this moment of celebration.
Indeed.
There are times when we must take time out and look at the past, see how people have come through, understand these celebratory moments, that our struggle and our tiredness is not futility. That even when sometimes we don't seem to get the kind of kudos and affirmations as we would like to kind of energize us on the journey, yet we're still making inroads. We still have an impact. And I think this is what is one of the achievements of this this thread of gold. One of the achievements of this book is kind of assuring us that we're still working the tapestry.
Indeed.
And Kat has taken us through different high moments of reclamation, recreation, and resilience. These are all positive words. These are all words which says, hey, yes, you've been through some rough times. Yes, we're in a hostile environment in some respects, inverted commas. But guess what? At the end of it, there is a tapestry being woven. And the imagery of, I think it was, is it Caravaggio?
Yes,
Caravaggio. The artist who does that work with, what is it, sea silk. And I see where that is the kind of, what you've done with words is what she does with her craft, in a sense. I see that is a kind of exemplar on which you're approaching your narrative. And in many respects, it works. And so I think, I can't remember the exact quote, but you did mention, underlined it somewhere, I can't find it now, but you did mention that we definitely have hope. And this is a book of hope. Thank you, Kat. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Kat Joy by name, Kat Joy by nature. Buy This Thread of Gold, A Celebration of Black Womanhood. Please, it's a great book. And You know, a question I was going to ask, but I'm not going to ask it, I'm just going to answer it, was why should men buy this book? And you know what? It was a great book. It was a great insight into the potential lives of my grandmother and beyond. Looking at the experiences of my auntie, you spoke of literally when you was describing your granddad sitting in the chair, your grandmother in the kitchen, you was describing my life, my actual life. So, you know, like it was mad to hit your cookie for 40 people in one oven. Yes. I literally met my cousins on Sunday and we were talking about, we don't know why Nan made 3 trays of chicken when 10 people were turning up. And she used to tell me, Kavan, the spicy chicken's in the top. I'm like, Nan, you don't even make a whole tray for me. But she would, because that's what she did. She made sure that when we were in that home, we were filled, fueled, and ready to go for whatever the world had to present to us. And we were prepared. And for me, it was a real connection to the women in my life. People like Marcella, who have really shaped the values that I now hold as a man. It was incredible. Buy the book, listen to it, read it, whichever way is your medium. Now I know there's a playlist. I'm definitely going to get stuck in once more. And I think it's perfect time to hand over to our audience and see if there's any questions in the audience. If there isn't, that's fine. We can move on. But if there is, please do go ahead.
One question.
Yep.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, so after your master's in Oxford, you had a lot of ideas and you did some research on that, and it actually informed your writing as well. Do you want to expand a bit on that?
Yeah, I think I tried to be as creative as possible with the research, because I think when you're moving out of an academic space and into, I guess, like a commercial book, I thought I don't have to stick to kind of, you know, journal articles and books written by other people. So I think getting out, like, for example, the interviews with the 50 Black women you spoke about, like, just interviewing people, just getting out and talking to people. And I, you know, my research became the world I was in, like, observations in the hairdressers. And I think that kind of thing was, for me, made it feel even more exciting. How can the world around me become infused with, like, journal articles and, you know, books from the last 50 years or whatever? So I kind of took the academic research and obviously still did a lot more and trawled the internet and the archives. But I think I also enjoyed bringing it to life by, yeah, getting out there in the world and meeting the people that the book is about and for in some ways.
Thanks, Patrice. Final question, and I'll give the last word to Marcella. Kat. Marcella's shaking her head, so all right. Kat, what is it you feel you have to prove?
This is maybe a weird answer, but I feel like I have to prove that we have nothing to prove.
I was so glad when you said that.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Couldn't have said that better.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Nothing to prove.
That nailed it.
And there you have it. That has been Before Our Friends Die on the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. This is a Jade Conversation. You've been joined by me, Kavan, Catherine Joy White, author of This Thread of Gold, A Celebration of Black Womanhood, and Dr. Marcella Day, an incredible lady and a set of incredible ladies who have joined me today. Thanks to our audience members. Patrice, thank you so much. Really appreciate you. And make sure you check out the Before Our Friends Die podcast on Instagram at Before Our Friends Die Pod. Aki and Saltfish on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all those amazing things. And Kat, where can they find you?
You can find me on all those places. Catherine Joy White on Instagram. I mainly use Instagram, but I am on also Twitter and TikTok. Kat Joy White.
Buy the book everywhere you can. I bought it on Audible. It's available in Waterstones. It's available directly from the
Amazon,
everywhere you can get this book. Make sure you check it out. And I'll make sure all of our social media details are below. I'll make sure the links are below. And finally, if you've got any questions or comments, please do email akiandsaltfish@gmail.com. And please leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps us grow. Like, comment, subscribe, all those algorithm things. I don't even know what it means, but please do it. It helps. That's been me. Take care and see you soon.